Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Due to some quirks in the calendar this year, today is Tax Day. And this year, it's estimated that Americans will spend 6 billion hours and $10 million in preparing and filing their taxes. My guest today, T.R. Reid, says it doesn't have to be that way, and that if history repeats itself, America will overhaul its tax system by 2018. 32 years since the last overhauls in 1986, 1954 before that, and 1922. In his new book, he writes that virtually every tax reform idea along the political spectrum has been tested in other countries, from flat taxes to a Wall Street speculation tax, a soda pop tax to internet taxes. A fine mess, a global quest for a simpler, fairer, and more efficient tax system is the Washington Post correspondent's latest book, an examination and comparison of the U.S. tax code to other industrialized democracies. And in it, he offers his best ideas to make U.S. taxation both simpler and fairer. But his proposals does get rid of many cherished parts of the tax codes and would at the least be disruptive. T.R. Reid is a correspondent for The Washington Post and a former chief of its Tokyo and London bureaus. He's a commentator for NPR and the author of The Healing of America, The United States of Europe, The Chip, and Confucius Lives Next Door. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. T.R. Reid, thank you very much for joining us.
Rich, great to be on your air again. Thanks.
Your book said, if history holds true, the U.S. is due an overhaul of its taxation system. That seems to be the underlying premise of a fine mess. Do you actually think it will happen in the next year or two?
I think it will for several reasons. For one thing, our tax code is a total mess. Nobody defends it. Nobody likes it. It's about 73,000 pages. I asked the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, has anybody at the IRS read the whole thing? And he laughed. I mean, the idea is crazy. Over time, with the IRS, the federal income tax started in 1913. And you know, Rich, at that time, we hate this tax today, but at the time it was very popular because it was only paid by the Vanderbilts and the Morgans and the Astors and like that. Over time, it expanded, and the lobbyists come in and write in exemptions and credits and allowances. Congress makes about 400 changes to the tax code every year, usually just to help one taxpayer. And it gets so complicated, it's such a mess, that the best thing to do is throw it out and start over. And we've done that three times, in 1922, 1954, and 1986. Those are 32-year periods, and guess what? The 32 years is up in 2018, so the time has come, if history repeats itself, and I think it tends to, that we are going to rewrite the tax code. And the way to do it, as I say, is throw out all those loopholes and exemptions, and then you can sharply lower the rate.
Now, you address the polarization in Congress today, and you write that in 86, you know, you had Ronald Reagan, popular Republican president, but a Democratic Congress for the most part, and yet they were able to find common ground. I look at today's polarization, and it makes 1986 look like a walk through the daisies. I mean, the polarization is so much greater. In fact, one party that controls the House says, we don't even want to work with Democrats. We have to get a majority of our caucus before we bring anything forward. It seems to me that something like tax overhaul has to be bipartisan.
Yeah, and I think the politics are there, and here's why. Democrats want to get rid of the allowances and credits and loopholes for specific businesses and for rich taxpayers. Republicans want lower rates, and those two go together. If you broaden the base and get rid of all the giveaways, then you can get much lower rates. That's what happened in 1986. In the 1980s, the top rate was 70%, the top income tax rate. They cut it to 28% with no loss of revenue because they got rid of so many exemptions and credits. And what I'm saying is, I went around the world, and this political mechanism has worked in many countries, and it could work here. So I think the time has come. Both parties would get something they want out of it. The American people would be delighted to have a simpler tax code. So the president has promised it. So, yeah, I tend to think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Now, there have been a number of polls that have come out over the last week or so that have been looking at how Americans feel about taxes. And And then, you know, there's some differing key findings from poll to poll, but there were a couple of very similar results, and that is that the rich and corporations, the perception that rich and corporations don't pay enough, and that the system is far too complex. And that seems to sort of follow a big portion of what you find in your book, that the rich don't pay enough. Now, corporations, that seems to be maybe a different matter. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right on both points. You know, in almost all countries, they've set graduated rates so that the rich pay a higher percentage of their income than low-income people do. Of course, they still have more left after they pay tax. But in the U.S., we have this unique system where the super rich, the top one-tenth of 1%, actually pay a lower tax rate than ordinary taxpayers. No other country does that. We ought to get rid of that. That's a loophole that was put in there by the lobbyists. So that's one we ought to fix. When people complain that the super rich don't pay enough in tax, they're right about that. And then when people say it's too complicated, they're absolutely right. You know, Americans spend about 6 billion hours a year compiling the data and filing the forms. We pay $10 billion to tax preparation companies. We spend $2 billion on this tax software that still takes hours to fill out. And guess what, Rich? It doesn't have to be that way. In other countries, filing your taxes takes 15 or 20 minutes and costs nothing.
I think you've actually detailed some countries where the tax service has all the numbers already. They send you a filled out tax reform. You look it over to see that it's correct, sign it, and you're done.
Yeah, exactly. I was in the Netherlands on March 31st. Their tax day is April 1st. And I was with this, you know, executive who makes a decent living. And I said, Michael, how do you pay your taxes? He said, well, I go online. I look at the form. The government knows all the numbers, so they've filled in the lines. He says, you know, but I don't trust government that much, so I start checking the numbers. Now he's getting mad. He says, you know, sometimes you start checking those numbers, it can take almost half an hour just to pay your taxes. He was ticked off. In Japan, the government sends you a postcard. It says, you made this much last year. We withheld this much. We owe you a refund of this much. We'll put it in your bank on April 1st. And you look at this postcard, and if the numbers look right, and they're almost always right, you do nothing. You don't have to file a return. And guess what? We could do that too.
Now, you did look at a number of countries, and one of the things that keeps popping up is this acronym BBLR, Broad-Based Low Rates. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, when I started on this book to figure out how to fix our tax code, I went to the economists at the World Bank, and they said, yeah, there's a formula for this, BBLR, broaden the base, and you can lower the rates. Here's what that means. Broaden the base means everything is taxable. Your income, your salary, that's taxable. If your employer pays for your health insurance premium, well, otherwise you'd have to shell out for that, so that's income. In many countries, they say if your employer gives you free parking, well, gee, that would cost you $20 a month, so that's income. So you tax all income, and then you don't give credits and exemptions. You say, look, you want to give money to charity, that's a good thing, but we're not going to give you a tax credit for it. You want to send your kid to school, that's a good thing, but we're not going to give you a tuition credit. And if you do that, if you broaden the base in that way, then you can sharply lower the rates and bring in the same amount of income. So New Zealand, for example, is kind of the model of BBLR. They broaden the base. They bring in more revenue per capita with rates that are about one-third of what Americans pay. And so here's what you get. If you do BBLR, you get a much simpler return, takes 10 minutes, and you have lower tax rates. And with the lower the rate, the more people are inclined to pay. You have much better compliance, because when the rates are really high, people think government is ripping them off and they're less inclined to pay.
Interesting. Now, a couple of those deductions you mentioned are sort of considered sacrosanct. The charitable deduction, the mortgage interest deduction, and I hear a lot of middle-class taxpayers, when they hear that, saying, hey, I depend on that. That is something that actually benefits me. But you actually did a little bit of research into it, and you said, you know, Even a mortgage interest deduction generally affects higher income taxpayers than lower income taxpayers. Even if you have the same house and the same amount of mortgage interest, the upper income taxpayer gets a bigger deduction.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In the first place, you only get that mortgage deduction if you itemize deductions, and two-thirds of taxpayers, two-thirds of homeowners, take the standard deduction, so they don't get any deduction for paying a mortgage. They get what they would get without it. And the argument for the mortgage interest deduction, so it's really only the richest third of taxpayers who make out with the mortgage interest deduction. The argument for it is, well, we need that to enhance homeownership, and homeownership is a good thing. But guess what? Lots of countries have gotten rid of the mortgage interest deduction, and there's no change in homeownership. Britain got rid of the homeownership of the mortgage deduction. They have higher homeownership rates than we do. So we really don't need it to enhance homeownership, and it's a benefit to the rich. And that deduction costs the government about $103 billion a year. This is money we could use to treat wounded veterans, you know, or reduce the deficit or build a stronger border if you want. And instead, we give it as a subsidy to the richest homeowners. Now, people who are getting that deduction now, we would need some kind of transition to help them out, because they've paid more for their house because the deduction raises home prices. But over time, you can work that out, and many countries have gotten rid of it. I think we ought to get rid of all those deductions and credits. You know, the U.S., we give a tax break for taking a night school course, paying property tax, growing sugar cane, replanting a forest, insulating the attic, destroying old farm equipment, employing Native Americans. There are hundreds of them in there. My argument is we ought to get rid of all of them. And so I took on the two most popular, the mortgage deduction and the charitable deduction, as examples of why we ought to do it.
You use the Stanley Suri, an economist that had a test for fairness, and he refers to all of these as not a deduction, but tax expenditures. I thought that was an interesting turn of phrase.
Yeah, he was a professor, a tax professor at Harvard, and he figured out that every one of these exemptions cost the government money, so he called them tax expenditures. And of course, it turns out that if you total all the tax expenditures, all the tax deductions, they cost more than any federal program. They cost more than Social Security, more than Medicare, more than Defense Department. And we don't really look at them because, hey, it's not spending, it's a tax cut. So, for example, I have the scene in my book where the president goes down to the Capitol and says to Congress, hey, I got a great idea. Let's send a check for $7,500 to any American who buys a $138,000 BMW hybrid car. Well, we would never give a giveaway to rich people buying German cars, except we did, Rich. It's in the tax code. It's called a tax deduction, and that's the kind of expenditure that our code is just full of. They add about 400 new ones every year, and if we didn't have those, the code would be simpler and the rates could be lower.
My guest today is Washington Post correspondent T.R. Reid. His new book is titled A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, if you did adopt in the United States a broad-based low-rate system, what would the top tax rates look like? Would it be a flat tax, for example?
No, I don't think a flat rate tax. That's several Republicans have proposed this last year.
Yes.
Six of the Republican candidates proposed a flat rate tax. And of course, the argument of my book is any idea that anybody's proposed for tax reform, some country has tried it. And about 12 countries tried the flat rate tax. Everybody pays 18%. It turns out not to work. You just can't set that rate high enough to bring in the revenue you need, but low enough for average working families to pay. You really need the graduated tax rate. So I don't think a flat tax would work.
To follow up on that, yeah. You said that most of those were Eastern European countries right after communism, and it actually worked for a short amount of time when sort of economic inequality wasn't that pronounced. As the country grew, that's when the flat tax sort of fell apart. And of course, in a very unequal economic system like the United States, where you have great inequality in wages and wealth, I don't think it would work, would it?
Yeah, that's my conclusion. Those countries in Eastern Europe, they just got out of the Soviet Union. Just about everybody in those countries was poor, so they didn't have a disparity of income. And they had no investment capital. They came up with this flat tax rate, and it worked for several years. People, Scandinavians, Germans came in and invested in those countries to take advantage of that low tax rate. And it worked for 6 or 7 years. And then what happened is when we had the global recession in 2008 and 9, that flat rate of tax didn't bring in enough revenue. And most of them have given it up. Some of them have kept the flat rate, but they have to make up the difference in other taxes. So Hungary has a flat rate of income tax. And to make up the difference, they have the world's highest sales tax. Their sales tax is 27%. On anything you buy. So I'd say it worked for a few years in former Soviet republics. I don't think it would work in the United States, and we've never done it for that reason.
Yeah. So if you had a graduated low rates under a broad-based low rates, what do you think the top rates would look like?
Well, currently our top rate is 39.6%. In 1980, our top rate was 70%. And they did the kind of reform I'm talking about. We did it in the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. That was the best tax reform in American history. The top rate came from 70% to 28%, and we raised the same amount of revenue because we got rid of a whole bunch of deductions. So I think if we did that kind of reform again, the top rate would come down from 39% to, 28, 25. An average working family would be paying taxes at 15 or 17%. They're now paying about 35%. So it would reduce rates for everybody way down below what we have now. The Treasury says if you got rid of all the exemptions and credits, we could reduce everybody's tax rate by 37%, and it would be much simpler to file the return. So I think a tax plan where the lowest income, the lowest tax rate is, say, 10%, 16%, and 28%. We could definitely get there.
Now, I remember the years after 1986 as a time when deficit exploded, but you said, basically the government took in the same amount of revenue. Was it a matter of politicians immediately adding in tax benefits, or was it a matter of not controlling spending, or what exactly?
The big growth in the deficit was the first 5 years of the Reagan era, 1981 to 1986. The national debt quadrupled in those 5 years. After the 1986 tax reform, revenues came about the same, and so we didn't add so much to the debt after that change. But the problem there was on the spending side. And what happened is, as you say, deficits went up. And first, two presidents, first the first Bush and then Clinton, raised taxes to offset this increasing deficit. And, of course, we all know that increased taxes stifle economic growth, right? Well, no. In the 1980s, after two tax increases, we had the biggest economic growth in our country in 50 years. In the 1990s, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So if you lower the overall income tax rates, you also talk about seriously lowering the corporate rate, too. Why that?
Yes, we ought to do that. What happened is in the 1980s and 90s, most rich democracies cut the corporate income tax rate. The United States did not do that. Therefore, most companies pay at a 35% rate. And that's higher than almost any other country. France, is a famous gouger of the rich, so they tax more. But most of our competitor countries have a lower corporate tax rate. And that's a serious competitive disadvantage for American companies. And the result is, since the rate is so high, it's in their interest to hire accountants and consultants to find ways to duck the tax. And American corporations are champions at ducking tax. I have a chapter in my book explaining the incredible machinations they go through to move their money overseas so they don't pay tax in the United States. So it's a tax that's unfair to American companies. It's not really bringing in much revenue. It would be much smarter to get rid of a bunch of exemptions and loopholes for corporations and then lower the rate so that it's more competitive. So I think when politicians, President Trump says we have to lower the corporate income tax rate, and what I say is looking at other countries, yeah, that would make sense for us. We ought to do that.
Now, what about the idea that companies taking profits offshore? Is there any way you can fix that in a global economy?
It costs money to do that. It costs money to set up the procedures. Google, for example, has a subsidiary in Bermuda that owns a subsidiary in Ireland that owns a subsidiary in Switzerland, all to move taxes overseas. And that's expensive to set that up and to run it. If the tax rate were lower, they wouldn't have to spend money on that kind of stuff. They could put it into innovation, you know, and investment. So we definitely would do better with a lower corporate tax rate, and companies would have less incentive to go through all these bizarre processes to move their profits.
Now, you do recommend one tax that is well known in most industrialized countries, but not here in the United States, and that is a VAT, a value-added tax. This is a staple in European countries. But the United States has never had it. Why do you think it's important for the U.S. to add it?
The value-added tax is kind of it's a sales tax that applies at every level of transaction for wholesale or retail. And economists like this tax because it's a tax on spending. It's a tax on consumption. It doesn't tax labor. It doesn't tax savings or investments. So economists like it. Governments like it because it's a very hard tax to evade. People really can't duck it. And it turns out the taxpayers like it because you use the revenue from that value-added tax to reduce the burden of the income tax, the corporate or individual income tax. So it's really a good idea, and 176 countries have adopted it. The only big country in the world that hasn't adopted it is the world's richest country, the USA. It just makes a lot of sense, particularly if you use it to lower the income tax that people have to pay. So, for example, this professor, Eric Zold at UCLA Law School, he said to me, he says, you know, that value-added tax is such a good idea, even the U.S. Congress will figure out. He says, mark my words, within 5 years, the U.S. will have a VAT. And then he says, of course, I've been saying that for 20 years.
When I think of a VAT, I think of that really hitting lower income households harder than upper income households. And certainly in a lot of states, you're seeing more regressive tax policies already. If you had a more regressive federal system, wouldn't that put the pinch on lower income households?
That's an absolutely fair question. That's a good objection. Yeah. Yeah. The value added tax can be regressive because, as you say, low-income people spend more of their money on consumption than upper-income people do. So that's true. But countries have found ways to deal with that. There are basically two ways. One is you don't charge the VAT, the value-added tax, on essentials like food, clothing, medical supplies, textbooks. That exempts stuff that people have to buy, but it gets complicated then. It's hard for the seller to know whether he has to apply the tax or not. I think a better way to do it is you give a credit on the income tax for the sales tax that people at a low income had to pay. So they come out the same, but you still collect that extra revenue that lets you lower the other taxes. So you're right, it's a regressive tax, but people have figured out ways to do that. We could handle that problem.
My guest today is T.R. Reid, a Washington Post correspondent and the author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fair, and More Efficient Tax System. And in our last couple of minutes here, I want to talk about a couple of things that you mentioned as far as looking at inequality, you know, economic inequality. For example, you talked about the super billionaires that pay, you know, Warren Buffett pays less than his secretary, for example, in a tax rate.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned is like, capital gains instead of having capital gains at a special rate. It becomes an income rate. The carried interest, which is, you know, how hedge fund guys make a gazillion dollars, get rid of that. And also something called the FAT, which is similar to the VAT, except it's on financial activities. It's a very tiny fee on Wall Street trading. That's been sort of punted around every now and again. Can this make a bit of money for the government and not hurt, the ability to trade on Wall Street?
Yeah, it's called the FAT tax, the financial activities tax. Bernie Sanders called it the Wall Street speculation tax. The striking thing is it's a tax on stock trades and derivatives and stuff like that. The interesting thing is it's a tiny tax. It's 0.0001%. So on a $1 million transaction, it's a $1 tax. So for you and me trading stocks now and then, it really makes no difference. But it brings in a lot of money because, you know, these high-speed traders do 100 trades a second. They do a $1 billion trade every hundredth of a second. You tax them at 0.0001%. You can really bring in serious money. Bernie Sanders said he was going to use that revenue to provide free tuition for everybody, and the numbers added up. It would have worked. Yeah. The European Union has a financial activities tax, and it brings in good money, and it really doesn't hurt average investors. So I think that one's a good idea. I propose that in my book.
Yeah. Well, supposing all this comes to pass, what happens to the multi-billion-dollar industry devoted to minimizing or avoiding taxes? You know, everything from law firms to tax services to computer software makers to accountants. What happens to them? I mean, will this create severe disruption?
You know what, Rich? We don't need that industry. I mean, you can walk down the street in London or Lima or Tokyo, and there's no H&R Block because it's an unnecessary industry. Yeah, those people would have to go find some other line of work. And this is what happens in vibrant societies. You know, nobody is making typewriters in the United States anymore. We used to employ a lot of people doing it. Well, they've moved on to new lines of work. It used to be that every city employed large squadrons of people to sweep up the manure behind the horses pulling the carriages. That industry is gone, too. This is what vibrant societies do. You get rid of unnecessary industries, and people move on to doing work that's more useful and more innovative. So that's what will happen. We should not have to spend $10 million a year just to file our income tax. No other country makes people do that. And that's money that we could put into something. We could, you know, cure cancer. We could build new parks. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we could do instead of paying somebody to fill out an incomprehensible tax return.
All right. Well, T.R. Reid, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
T.R. Reid is a correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.